Now, welcome to Michael, who has managed to get here through the traffic. Thank you.
Good morning.
Of all the bright young things who illuminated the roaring 20s of the jazz age, none shone brighter than Scott Fitzgerald and his young wife, Zelda Sayre. Their attraction, his fame, and their wildly hedonistic lifestyle are the subject of Beautiful and Damned, a new musical named after one of Fitzgerald's titles. And Michael Praed, you're going to be taking the part of Fitzgerald himself. It's not an easy role. You go from the age of 18, a young soldier meeting Zelda in Alabama, to a premature death at 44, hitting the heights with Great Gatsby and sliding downhill into alcoholism. Do you think this was a great man, now that you've had to get into his biography?
That all depends upon your definition of great. I mean, he has certainly had a profound literary impact, ironically, after his death. And for me, the thing that is elicited whenever I think of him is just this tremendous compassion for this individual who wanted so much, got it, and then lost it all. And that he's considered now one of the, certainly of the 20th century, one of the literary heavyweights. And yet the irony that during his own lifetime he considered himself really an unabashed failure. And that's tremendously sad.
Also sad that though he and Zelda were so attracted to each other, he pretty well stymied her career. Do you think she might have made it? Some of her stories, for example, were published under his name because publishers simply said, well, we're not going to sell them as Zelda Sayre, are we? Well, and what a frustrating thing for them to be sold with his name on them.
Frustrating, absolutely. And also, if you can consider the dynamic, perhaps, of the rivalry situation, she suffers, I think, by the comparison test that, you know, her literature, by comparison to his, is going to fail. But nevertheless, she was a signally gifted woman of her own right, and not just as a writer, but as a painter and as a dancer. And if you compared her to, say, one of her contemporaries, I think she would stand up somewhere.
Okay. We know you as Robin of Sherwood. Do you mind my saying that?
Why? Why should I?
I don't know. I mean, I just wonder if you say, oh, no, not. Don't bring that up again.
No, some people do, though, don't they? I'm sure the people you've interviewed resent the fact that...
On horseback?
Yes, on horseback. There you are. You were Robin on horseback.
Yeah. I was. Very badly on horseback, but that's another story.
And I'm not allowed to say man in tights either. No, they were green trousers, fetchingly cut.
No, you can say anything you like, I don't mind. But they weren't tights, no. Although I did wear tights underneath them because the things itched.
Yeah. And then you went on to be Prince Michael in Dynasty. Mm-hmm. David, you remember? You remember Dynasty and Michael playing Prince Michael in that? Because I think you're a TV fiend. Is that
right? I was more daytime television, soap operas. In Dynasty, a lot of people... Dynasty was huge in the United States, but I usually watched the day because you could get it every single day.
Mm. So the evening one's a bit too upmarket and well-made for you, huh?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. So Robin of Sherwood, I don't know if you can bring anything from that, but at least making TV programs and some of the movies you've made must be a very different skill to getting up on stage and hoofing and singing night after night.
Well, obviously the salient difference is that on a stage you're completely in control of your performance, and when you do the other, you're not entirely. And sometimes that's a virtue and sometimes it isn't. But there is... They're just very different techniques, and I don't necessarily prefer one to the other.
So you like having a live audience there that you've got to warm up and bring on with you?
I do. I do very much like that, and particularly with a musical, which again differs from a play. Occasionally, but quite profound can happen, because we all are aware of that visceral quality that only really music has, that it can actually... or change your chemistry when you hear something that does happen to strike you, and there is a resonance from the audience to the performer, and it feeds upon itself.
Rather perverse, I thought, seeing a preview, that here you are epitomising the man who chronicled the jazz age and may actually have named the jazz age, and there's hardly a note of jazz in the musical.
Yes, you'll have to bring that up with the writers, the musicians. No. But then again,
Odd, though, wouldn't you say?
It's fair criticism. I'm just going to hold my hands up at that one and try to definitely segue into something relatively intelligent to deflect what you have perhaps brought up. Jazz, no. I mean, you could look at the score of Sunset Boulevard. Here's my defence. There's not necessarily much 1940s music in that, if that's indeed where it's set. So... The show has a, if I'm going to defend the music, the show has an absolute musical, what is the word that I'm searching
integrity?
For? Flavour.
Uniformity? Integrity.
Yeah. And so the fact that it isn't, quote, in the jazz idiom, that's not, in fact, what they were going for. But it's a fair point, though.
An interesting subject, though. A woman driving herself mad, you could say. A man descending into an alcoholic torpor. And there you're all singing and dancing about it and saying what a jolly time they're having. It's quite an interesting tension to portray that.
Well, yes, that's one of the, you know, to play the opposite sometimes. In fact, what's happening is one of the nice intrigues about theatre.
What have you been doing between Michael and Dynasty and now?
Well, that is some 20-odd summers.
Yeah.
So quite a few different and varied things. I mean, everything really, ranging from television to films to plays and.
Yeah, I went around the internet having a little look to see what you might have been up to, and there was some movie about a lot of dead gay men. What on earth was that?
Oh yes, that was Nine Dead Gay Guys.
Yeah, and,
yeah. It's become something of a cult film.
Is it?
Yeah, I play a character called the Queen. I wear more makeup. Wear more makeup than Joan Collins did, which was one of the chief reasons for doing the part in the first place. I really
should say Joan Collins wasn't in it, was she?
She was not in it. No,
no, no, exactly.
No, not at all. I really enjoyed playing that. The older I get, the more chance I get to play varying characters. And it's actually very hard to play a hero because you always win and you always get the girl. Much more interesting to play some silly queen who ends up getting rogered by a little dwarf with some vast cow prod. At least that's how it was in the original script. I don't know how it ended up in the final cut.
You didn't see it?
I have seen it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but only on a video, and I hadn't seen it in the cinema.
I think it's a bit unfair to go on the internet to look at somebody's past, really.
What, is it?
Yes.
Oh, contrary.
What might I cover?
I can't believe I'm sitting next to a major star from Dynasty. This is the best thing we've had since Greek mythology. I always think it was the winner of all soaps.
And a horse rider.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm trembling.
It was an epic series, wasn't it?
Wonderful.
It was.
I mean, people used to delay the migrations, I was told, in North Africa. And there were tribes who wouldn't leave because on their mini televisions they had to watch the next episode of Dynasty. I mean, it had a real global outreach, and it set a ghastly standard. I looked for the first time and thought, my God, this high-rise, high-business, Texan, extravagant life is ghastly. It was wonderful. It was against itself. Michael was a fantastic character. This is a great moment.
You can get his autograph later on.
Definitely.
And will you be going to see the show of Scott and Zelda?
Well, I adore Scott Fitzgerald. I must say firmly, Zelda may have had a talent. She could never have written Great Gatsby.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a fair comment, I think. Michael, enjoy yourself in Beautiful and Damned, running at the Lyric Theatre at Shaftesbury Avenue. Do you know how long you're going to be doing it for? Has it got in for months?
No, we haven't opened yet. Next Monday we open. Coming Monday.
For how many months?
For a year, I think.
Oh, well, fantastic.
We should see.
May I ask, do you have to play drunk a lot in the play?
Yes.
Because that seems so difficult when you see real drunkenness in real life. It's just so tiresome and so boring, and it seems so difficult to make that work on stage because you're almost like a super drunk. You're like the super entertaining
Uber drunk.
Drunk.
Yeah. Well, the trick is not to play drunk. The trick is to play somebody drunk trying to be sober.
Oh. Ah.
Yeah. Yes, you do. And Hemingway takes you to task and upbraids you quite a lot. Ernest Hemingway.
Yes.
I mean, imagine watching Ernest Hemingway just four rows away from me. That was an extraordinary thing. And he is very fed up with the state that you get into.
Yes.
Well, pots and kettles, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you go in for method acting before this part and get drunk?
No, I didn't. There are no.
No. Well, people can see Beautiful and Damned for themselves. Which brings me to David Sedaris, talking about drugs. But that's your druggy past we might come on to. I was more interested in the fact that you're a former Macy's Christmas elf. House cleaner would be hippie. And you turned your life story.